Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 27. Now, anything else about this time in Egypt? It sounds
well,
quite interesting.
Yeah, when we first arrived, I had to wait for a quarter, and married quarter, and when my family first arrived in 1951, the treaty had just been abrogated. So we already had a house in Ismailia, which we went and took residence there for about 3 weeks. But we were confined because of the political situation. We were literally confined to a quarter. So the first thing we when they went shopping to the Nafi, which was local, I had to go armed. I had to carry a Sten gun and a pistol and keep both hands free. So it was a bit difficult with kids in prams and walking and so on. Anyway, we managed to get some stuff from the Nafi, bread and tin milk and sausages, tin bacon. These are the things. It was that's ideal milk. My son was only, 4 months old, or 3 or 4 months old. We fed on this ideal carnation milk. And then, of course, as soon as it got dark, they started shooting in Ismailia itself, which isn't very funny. It was mainly the Brits that were firing, I suppose, mainly. But my daughter, who was then 7, can still remember the confrontations and the firing from the rooftops. Anyway, it only lasted about 3 weeks, and then the families were evacuated. Having sailed out 3 weeks earlier on a troop ship, they were evacuated by air. And in these days, there wasn't any facilities for trooping proper. And my family were evacuated in a Hastings with paratrooper seats, you know. And my wife had with her 3 children, an infant of 4 months, and my 2 daughters. It wasn't very funny. And they got to Malta, and there was no transport from at Malta, and that type of thing. And they had to hang about. And eventually, when they finished up in UK, some aircraft went US at Malta, that's right, and they had to sit in the mess there for a while. But then there was no organization to cater for families. Eventually they got back to Cliff Pypard, it was, and they had to stay overnight at Cliff Pypard in a freezing cold mess, and then were dispersed subsequently to Blackpool. Bearing in mind that all the kids, they got rid of all their winter clothing when they had left UK some 3 weeks before, and they were now returning to UK virtually clad only in summer wear. Anyway, they eventually finished up in Blackpool at some hotel away down at Squire's Gate end of Blackpool. A cramped, they were all in, if I remember correctly, all in one room. It wasn't very popular. But they stayed there for a short while, for about three or four months, until finally they got themselves a house, and then we eventually got back to our own property in Nottingham. Not without difficulty, because I had let that house as a hiring. And, you know, it was a long lease, and they didn't like the idea of me going back in. So they eventually got in. But it's just one of these things. But yeah, it wasn't very pleasant for the families. It certainly made the Air Force think, and it cost us a lot of hard cash because we got nothing back for our goods and chattels that we had left behind in the flats that we had rented. And of course, Ismailia became a centre of a lot of fighting subsequently, and it was for another year before my family came out, and the next time they came out, how did they come out by the air? Yeah, they flew out. And things were not too bad that then, but it was quite an experience for them. The kids were much older, of course, but there was still a lot of unrest. So having said all that, the CO was still the same CO. He wasn't very sympathetic. But the work progressed. There's some amusing incidents. When the RAF regiment came out to take over some of the duties, they brought their Bofors guns out, and they said, oh, we must go and test fire these. So we issued them with, from the depot, 40mm Bofors ammunition, which they came and collected, and they took them out into the desert and set up their battery of guns, or whatever they're going to take, and stacked all the ammunition. And for some reason or other, guns wouldn't fire, or there were some problems with them. So they stacked all the ammunition very neatly, put red flags around it, and returned to base to get the guns rectified. And so when they went out the following day to fire the guns, lo and behold, there was no 40mm ammunition. And they said, well, you know, we could have told you they'd been nicked, and they'd been nicked overnight by the locals, local Arabs. So we had to issue them another lot of ammunition. And we said, well, this time put a guard on it if you have to leave. So that was always an amusing incident. But not to be repeated. The local Arabs were amazing. This ammunition depot, which we were, an army ammunition depot, on which we were based, had a satellite or storage site a bit further up the near Ismailia. It was an island off in the north end of the, and this island was used as storage for ammunition by the army. And the story came during one night. The locals nicked 10,000 rounds of 40mm. That's the stuff that we had in boxes of 24 from this island. And obviously the purloined it for brass. They were used to use it for making things apart from most things. But that's a story which went down in the annals of the Canal Zone, I guess. Incidentally, only just recently in the last year, which was 2005, they managed to get a Canal Zone ribbon medal issued for that period, 30 years. Quite amazing. Anyway, let's move on to, we were at Muntowaite MU, and then we eventually, I was posted to UK.
When did you leave?
On the 26th of January, 54. Yeah, and on the Empire Ken, SS Empire Ken, troop ship. The Empire Ken was utility troop ship. Anyway, it was subsequently sunk somewhere along the line.
And what happened when you got back to England?
Well, I was posted then initially at a holding at Hucknall, which was 43 Group Headquarters. I was there for a very brief period, but I was then posted in the March, having taken disembarkation leave and got back into my house, which I was in Nottingham and all that. I was posted to 21MU Fold. That's at Tutbury, Burton-on-Trent. I went there in March 54, and I stayed in March 54 until April 57.
And what was this setup like at Fold?
Oh, Fold was good. Fold was a pre-war unit. It was an explosive storage unit, and it had the provision and stock control officer for all the explosives units in UK, and there was something in the region of, at that time, 11 or 12. They were all stock controlled from 21MU, and we also had the responsibility for overseeing and stock checking of the fuel reserves in the UK. Now, and of course, there was some permanent married quarters there, which I ultimately got one. No, I tell a lie. At that time, first time visit, they weren't built. They were under being constructed. And they had a little mess, nice, comfortable, wooden structured mess. But we had permanent headquarters and the PS, Provincial Stock Control Officers, and it was in a Seco hut adjacent. My duties there was fuel aspect. So apart from accommodation and being in the building with the stock controllers for the explosives units, which was next door, I didn't have anything to do with the explosives units per se. But I obviously knew about them, and I knew how to operate the systems. And when a guy went on holiday from the explosive side, we just moved down the corridor and sit in his chair. And it was manned by civilians, and the main function was to control the input of new explosives to the explosive depots throughout the Air Force, and the disposal of explosives from these depots.
And did they actually have explosives and fuel there at Fold?
At Fold, we only had detonators and small arms ammunition.
And any fuel?
No fuel.
So your role?
No, no fuel. I'll come to the fuel separately. The fuel, the explosive reserves of fuel were held in 250 civilian operated fuel storage units throughout UK, like these depots that you like, just like the one at Richland. Now the RAF reserves were all held in these, and all these units were operated by civilian contractor, and the stock conditions and maintenance was responsibility through the MP, through the to MOD. E29 was the branch. Our responsibility was to visit these civilian fuel depots regularly throughout the time, inspect what they were doing with the stocks, receive stocks into the depots, and check the stocks, physically dip the tanks now and again, and authorized transfers of fuel from one tank to another tank, dipping them before and after, and stuff like that. Oil, we used to receive oil into these depots as well. We had a big oil storage, bulk oil storage. We used to receive it from the refinery and check its arrival. It used to come by rail car, and we had to offload that. We had to be there, witness the offloading and dip in the fuel tank. We used to dip the tank cars to discharge the oil. These tank cars were preheated from the depots, oil in particular, oil specifically rather. The old-fashioned lubricating oil, I use that phrase, the stuff we use in cars, it wasn't all weather. When it got cold, it got very hard, very tacky, very viscous. Is that the word, viscous?
Yep. Yeah.
And therefore, you had to move it mainly in the summer months. When it was when it was manufactured, it was discharged into these cars at about 100 degrees C. And when it finally got to the depot, it could be anything. But the warmer it was, the better. If it wasn't warm, then the depots had to pump steam through the tank car pipelines to thin it out to get it discharged. Always a bone of contention, but we move most of our oil in the summertime. So that was my job. And out of this, we had something in the region. We had MT fuel. We had aviation 100 octane, aviation 140 octane. We had turbine fuel. And we had all sorts of other, we had pack stocks, sun packs, not much, and things of that. There. We also had a contract for the recovery of used oil. So contrary to popular belief, when it was drained out of aircraft or drained of transport, it went in, it went for refining, refining part of the, didn't get very much for it, but when they got the synthetic oils out, we got quite a lot for the recovery of synthetic oils. Quite, when I say a lot, it was a lot. I'm talking now about this period of time, 1950. It was, you probably got about 7 and 6 for every gallon of recovered. It was very expensive, this diesel oil. Synthetic lubricant oil, which are used in diesel and jet engines. So, yeah, the only highlight of my fuel career at Fold was, in fact, it was the Suez crisis. I had in my office, I set up in my office, rather, a progress chart for ships. It was all done on the telephone. I had to phone, I'd get the requirement from MOD for N thousands of gallons of fuel in barrels, and I had to then relay the information to the various contractors, and any contractor, Shell, Esso, or Shell, Esso, and somebody else, there's another one. Shell, Esso, three. Can't remember now. There were three main contractors, but each in turn got the general contract. And when I was there, it was Shell, and then it changed after 3 years, or the 3 years elapsed, and it went to Esso. But we were in contact with their staff at higher levels. So that, yeah, when we phoned up and asked for 10,000 gallons, we knew who we were talking to. We knew what it entailed in terms of where. And then they would lay on a ship, and we would have to document the barrels of oil, and then tell these contractors to ship them off, to mark the drums, how to mark them, and where to send them, and when they had to get, all that sort of thing. Well, that went on for the whole of the Suez crisis, and it was a nightmare. I think I had 24 ships on the go at one stage. I mean, my job was A, to get the shipping space, and B, get the fuel on the board from these devious contractors, and do the documentation, and then at the end of the exercise, to raise the, as an equipment officer, raise the financial recovery documents. It's rather ridiculous, but I mean, it all had to be paid for, and we had to send bills out. Anyway, to cut a long story short, this went on for the duration of the Suez crisis. And of course, the other problems with shipping, when the fuel arrived at the, it usually went by rail, when it arrived at the port of embarkation, you would have leaking drums, or you'd have leaking drums en route, which all had to be taken off and replaced and all this. And anyway, to cut a long story short, we sent them out from Davis ports, nearly all South Wales, actually. Oh, they went from lots of different ports. Falmouth, South Wales, Barry, Swansea, people, and Southampton. But that was a coordinating task. It went all right, but then the exercise, the Suez crisis went ahead. Fortunately, it was over territory I knew, so I wasn't really very worried about it. Documentation of explosives and fuels we did in abundance when I was at 128 MU, both outward and outward particularly, because we were sending stuff all over the place. And so it was not, there's a certain routine of documentation, the bills of lading for the ship, and you have to produce these bills of lading, and you have to calculate the storage space required. It was a very interesting job, really. It did have a one or two hiccups, actually. I remember two things. We always had to measure up the containers in order to calculate the cubic capacity, and there are certain sums you do to find out what the shipping tonnage is. And so you measure up the boxes and you multiply it by n number of boxes and you come out with a figure. That was very fine. And then MOD, in their wisdom, produced a shipping guide, inverted commas, in which it listed all the explosives, all the types of containers, and everything else that you would want to know, explosives groups and so on. And when this thing up, I said to the chap, I said, look, it's all very well, this, but some of these containers don't worry. Oh, don't worry about that. They don't match your book, you see. I said, oh, just use the book. So I did. So I used the book, and I remember using the book one day. And when the stuff, it was going from Middle East to UK, and when it arrived at the depot, arrived at the shipping port, it was the local group headquarters rang me up, and they were going berserk because the space available didn't equate. I said, well, these are the figures that you calculated, and the calculations are correct. I said, it's the wrong packages we've used. We've used the information given in as per instructions. So I said, you know, it's not my fault, it's your fault for, you know, insisting that we stick to, anyway, they shoveled, there was a shipping delay because they had the ship's master had to juggle with the items. You can't store stuff below decks, you know, certain. That was one thing that happened to me. And another thing happened to me. We had amassed over years at this depot, 1-2-M, all the 45-gallon drums, which were big, quite a big item. And they were all charged at a fiver a head, so we had to go back to the depot to recover our money. We'd just been stacking them up. I think there's about 7,000 or 8,000 of these things. So I said to the guy, look, it's time we got rid of this. I mean, they're rotting here because they were getting sandblasted. I said, and besides, I said, we got a £5 deposit on every one of these. We should recover that money. I'll get that money back. So they said, yeah, that's a good idea. So I said, well, where do I send them? So they said, oh, they rang me back, said, here's the address to send them. And so I wrote this address down. I never forget this. And I thought, that's a strange address. But anyway, I documented it to this address. I'll never forget it. 144 Fenchurch Street. Fenchurch Street, London. I thought it was a bit strange. Anyway, that was the address I was told to send the document. I would consign them to. And I found out subsequently. Well, I did. MOD rang, sent me a very nasty letter saying I'd consigned them to the incorrect address. I said, well, you know, that was the address I was given to. Apparently, this was the head office. So there was a bit of a, that's, well, not my fault, really. If you want to, so I was always very meticulous about, well, for that very basic reason, who I've got to contact at the where am I going to send them? What's their address? And what happens if the place is shut? Where do they go? And I used to interrogate these people. Eventually, so it never happened again. But that was I could just imagine the guy's face. So there must have been about 25. There must have been 25 10-ton lorries in the queue. I never found out who, but where they went. But they obviously went back to one of the depots. But then subsequently, the canal zone wound up, and we were in the process of running it down and disposing of all the explosives, dumping a lot in the sea. I left at that period of time, which was in fact before I got to Fold eventually. Fold. We went back to Fold, didn't we? PSC at Fold. We did the fuels, we did the explosives. There wasn't anything else exciting there. Oh, the only thing that was exciting was basically we had an outing to, whilst at 21MU Fold, we had an underground mines rescue team, which had been trained at this place down at the Mines Rescue Training Centre. Can't remember what it was now, it could come back to me. And I had a week's visit there, actually, where they trained the miners. You know, when I say train them, you donned the gear and you went into a pitch black environment and you crawled around these little shafts, little this high, you know, about 18 inches off the ground. It was very interesting for us as acquaintances to the system. But it was a tough course. But all miners apparently went through this course. It's a funny name. I'll look it up on the map. So anyway, when I finished at Fold.
That was in April 57.
Yeah, I'm just looking for April 57 posted. Yeah, and I was posted then to MOD, Ministry of Defence, Department E-29. Department E-29 was an explosives provisioning department. Explosives provisioning. In other words, we had a direct liaison with the Ministry of Supply, who made the stuff. And the ordnance factories who made the stuff. And the technical branch who designed the stuff and processed it, and the ordnance board who categorized it. And it was quite, and we also had to develop our case to put it to the financiers to get financial approval to buy it, that type of thing. When I got there, I didn't really like the job. I was put on the admin side, really, of finding out what units held in the way of, monthly returns on, and queries on overseas issues and types of explosives, and packaging was a big number of packages, because at that time there was a shortage of packages and things. When I say package, I mean boxes. And then the retrieval of empties and items from units. During this period of time, I wasn't there all that long, was I? From April 87, yeah, to October 59. During that period, two things happened that was sticking in my mind. One was we had the airlift was in force. The Berlin airlift was in force. And we had a shortage of engine starter cartridges for the Javelin aircraft. Now, when you talk about an engine starting cartridge, you probably envisage something like a glorified shotgun cartridge. Well, the early ones used to be, but as the aircraft got bigger, they became like a 25-pound shell. They were in a big brass case about 4 or 5 inches in diameter and probably a foot long. I mean, that was the thing we were talking about when we talked about starting cartridges for a Javelin aircraft. And what this did was it fired the gas into the jet engines and turned it over, and eventually it fired up. We had a big problem with those. And at one stage, the stock level was down to less than 48 hours supply. That was throughout the whole of the Javelin force. So we had to get a big stick out to MOD, and I had to do the rounds of the unit and find out. And the MOD kept on saying there was a shortage of boxes, And we said, well, there's no shortage. There's great heaps of them. Anyway, to cut a long story short, somebody in the Ministry of Supply got stick over that because it was maladministration. We had the boxes. They just weren't calling them forward for the project. So they did wriggle out of that in the end. And the other item that happened